You're listening to a 3CR podcast created in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
And a very warm welcome back to Solidarity Breakfast.
A left response to the major developments in capitalism.
What they trade in is not wheat. They trade in famine.
A little dose of revolutionary optimism.
I think it's really important to sort of express solidarity globally.
It really is a deal by corporations for corporations.
The union forever defending our rights. Down with the black leg.
If you think the ABC's left wing, don't listen to this program.
Solidarity Breakfast, 7:30 to 9 a.m. Saturdays, 3CR, 8:55 a.m. Streaming and 3CR digital, podcast or audio on demand. And of course, the website, solidaritybreakfast.org.au.
Solidarity forever!
Good morning, everybody. I hope you're all wrapped up. It's really chilly out there, and we've got Tobiah in the audience here who came at the nick of time because, of course, the important things of life are sport.
The Socceroos were playing. Had to watch the boys. It's good. It's good seeing such an intercultural team play together.
It's funny you should say that because whenever they've shown on the mainstream news, as someone said, we shouldn't call them the mainstream news. We should call them the Boswellers news. They only show pictures of white boys practicing, which I thought was really interesting.
I mean, yeah, they'd have to try pretty hard because the team's fairly mixed. Like, I mean,
well, yeah, it is,
and they played incredibly good game. And for everyone that braved the cold and was out at Fed Square at 4 a.m.
Oh, there's a lot of people out in the city. They were pretty excited, but obviously they didn't win. Is that right?
Yeah, on penalties. It was a bit unfortunate. But that's the way the game goes. And yeah. I mean,
that's the way the cooking.
You know, it's another thing. Like we were saying with Anila last week, especially when we do our little weather roundup, which of course you'll feel if you stick your hand outside your window that
that's
it is quite brisk.
Yes,
it is quite a fresh morning. But that all these aspects like sport or like the weather are actually, you know, they might seem like idle chit-chat, but actually they're inherently political things. Like the weather, we were noting that the rains haven't come yet.
There's been a bit of rain, but it's been sparse. I know someone who lives in Hong Kong and apparently it's been raining buckets. So there you go. Maybe it's all happening at that end of the spectrum.
Yeah, maybe the seasons have all pushed a bit more forward.
Who knows? Obviously it's changed. Something's changed. This is the APAN reminds us that we mark 1,000 days of the ongoing Zionist genocide against the Palestinians in Gaza. Despite the so-called ceasefire agreement, Israel continues its settler colonial project, expanding its military occupation to over 80% of Gaza, with finance minister calling to complete the conquest of the Gaza Strip and establish three new illegal Israeli settlements in northern Gaza. In the illegally occupied West Bank, Israeli forces bulldozed at least 500 olive trees in Zubaba, Jenin, only days after setting fire to olive groves in Ramana. These attacks are part of an ongoing campaign aimed at displacing Palestinian farmers, erasing Palestinian heritage and identity, and tightening control around colonial outposts. But there's been some movement in regards to people who have left Australia, Zionists who've left Australia to join the IOF. The Australian Centre for International Justice, the ACIJ, handed a 61-page brief to the Australian Federal Police detailing alleged war crimes and crimes against humanity committed by an Australian citizen serving in the Israeli occupation forces in 2023-24. The AFP is assessing the allegations. Up to 1,000 Australian citizens have served in the Israeli occupation forces since October 2023. And despite the Israeli army's advice about how they can infiltrate and disguise their presence in a foreign army when they come back, I suppose the general population of Australia should be a bit scared.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Especially, we were watching at our house last night, we were watching a documentary on Cuba, and about a couple of Australians that took part in the flotilla that went from Mexico to Cuba to deliver life-saving aid. And it was quite stark how even America was labeling that operation. They labeled it, just while you were saying about the sort of effect on the ground that the Zionist army's having, they were labeling it the total extermination campaign across all the so-called drug cartel boats and across the Cuban people. And you know, this documentary showed the effect on the people. That was, you know, hospital services completely racked with power outages or insufficient medicine or
well, I was thinking about Venezuela and its the effects of the earthquakes, devastating earthquakes in the past. Cuban doctors and medical aid would go immediately to that site. But of course, under the present conditions, they're going to have to rely on their US overlords. And we've seen how the US overlords assist their own people when they have disasters. So with the flooding in Texas, what happened in New Orleans when there was devastating floods, horrendous, horrendous.
Well, that's exactly right. And the US have used this as a pretense, this environmental disaster as a pretense to continue their move on in to sequester more aspects of Venezuelan political and civil life, now filling up more humanitarian, you know, aid roles and stuff like that. But in effect, taking more control of the company and of the country.
Yeah, that was the Freudian slip.
Yeah. Well, I mean, yeah, they are taking control of the companies, the oil ones.
Yeah, yeah.
And
well, countries as companies.
Yeah, well, in this, we saw that, in this doco last night, we saw that Haiti gets 75% of its doctors from Cuba, and that since America's attacks on Venezuela,
yeah,
and they've pulled all the doctors out of Haiti. So
yeah, Haiti is an ongoing disaster created by if you go back and watch Anthony Lowenstein's Disaster Capitalism film, there's a whole section around what's going on in Haiti, the collapse of the Haiti civil society over generations. It's like this enormous payback to the Haitians for having the temerity to
overthrow their slave lords.
Their slave overlords in the 18th or the 19th century, right? It's like the America. It's like John Howard. He had a long memory.
Yeah.
He remembered his enemies and then sent out the feelers to get rid of them decades after he felt this smart. But anyway, there was a glimmer of positivity here locally. The Police Accountability Project reports that Jordan Brown's legal win as the lead plaintiff in the class action over unlawful use of capsicum spray by Victorian police at IMART protests in Melbourne in 2019, it was a success. And Jordan spent 6 years fighting for justice, 6 years. Police Accountability Project Director of Policy and Advocacy Michelle Reynolds presented Jordan with the Victorian Civil Justice Award from the Australian Lawyers Alliance, which he had accepted for him in May. So that you may not have realised that actually happened, that people fight back on a continuous basis with a focus. You may also have been at the IMAC event in 2019. It's really funny because I was at the event, so it's an interesting thing to realise that there's an anchor in the future of you know, slowly but surely saying that the militarisation of the police using public money to attack the people who are paying for it, like paying for our own subjugation, is an issue, and that people are, it's not an inevitability, it's something that has to be fought.
Yeah, we've seen that. We reported on a similar case in Italy when there was an activist at a rally that was shot at eye level with tear gas canister and lost her eye. So that prompted a whole campaign that's then now ended up in the courts and has found one of the constitutional courts has found that the police have been using without authorization and in dangerous ways tear gas canisters and sort of riot stuff. That still hasn't led to any convictions, but it is now in the courts.
It can't be let go. It can't be allowed. I know it's incredibly the parallel universes of the incredibly slow legal process versus the terrible effects on people at the moment that it happens. But it's something to be taken into account. Our friend Matthew's not here this morning because he's unwell. We send you our best wishes, Matthew. But he did a lot of gathering of information around AI. And one of them in particular was Music Victoria had put out information, has set up a system where musicians can check to see if their work is being used, scraped, by the oligarchs, effectively, for their own ends to create AI music, which is an oxymoron, of course, because music is are the tears of culture from humans, not the tears of culture from machines.
Well, yeah, when it's increasingly been used to train algorithms, which then produce music that then goes on to get sold to advertisers or to other commercial ends, and these are the end products of these AI scraping algorithms.
Well, many of them have been very shocked to discover what has happened to their music, and there was a recent Instagram post by Arts Australia around the same theme, where software has been used to create music for these musicals that have become economically exciting for the last decade or so when they stopped. But now what they're doing is using software to reduce the amount of people they need to be in the orchestra pit. So as they say it, if you think you're going to see a musical because you're celebrating the live emotions of a live event, you should be thinking twice about what's actually going on in regards to the use of AI to reduce the amount of musicians who are being paid for their work.
Yeah, that's right. And that's another in the raft of neoliberal policies that's being pushed on the sides. But one of the more glaring one of the more glaring elements of this is the NDIS cuts. I just wanted to bring it back to a Red Ant article that they wrote in April 30th, just briefly, because I think they outline pretty perfectly why this is happening. So they say that the government is cutting $35 billion from the NDIS, and it's not just a misallocation of funds that's the problem. Even if finding $53 billion for missiles is a clear demonstration of where priorities lie, the NDIS has never actually been about care. Instead, it's been a cash cow for private providers. While being marketed as a national insurance scheme right from the start, the NDIS was designed explicitly along neoliberal lines to privatise disability services. And they take a quote out of the NDIS market approach statement of opportunity and intent, saying, quote, "The National Disability Insurance Scheme is a transformational approach to disability support and services that is creating a radically new disability marketplace, a fundamental shift disrupting existing operating models from a welfare to a market-based system where people with disabilities can choose their supports through individualized commissioning." I just wanted to highlight that because
the language, but
even in the doco where we were watching about Cuba last night, which was on YouTube, you can look it up. The channel's called Boy Boy, two Australian content creators that go around doing kind of publicity stunts, but then ram it full of political content in the middle of that. They highlight some of the healthcare system, how it works in Cuba, and we saw that the doctors, not only do they have regular checkups with their patients, but also it's mandatory for them to go out to the house, to the patient's house, every 2 weeks and check out how they're living, because they say there's a you know, the psychological is a connection to the biological, and maybe there's a biological connection to the psychological, and just a completely different thing. Even
you mean it's possible?
It is possible, yeah.
Oh my God!
Under blockade, is it possible? Under,
it's possible.
Yeah,
yeah, to have a proper holistic health system. If we look at governments and money and large pots of it, and the idea that the government in their suits and their, you know, nice hairdos, etc., are doing the right thing, there was a rather disturbing thing coming out of Deep Cut, taxpayer-funded Australian sugar industry linked to abuses in West Papua. Sugar Research Australia developed a sugarcane variety to grow in West Papua. Months later, the UN accused Indonesian companies of displacing Indonesian people, indigenous people, to make way for sugarcane production. So the connection between our public money for a cash crop and West Papua and the death of West Papuans is that close.
Yeah, exactly. And these are the neo-colonial practices that Australia's engaging with when we saw the pretty unilateral military.
Are we being too emotional?
Yeah.
I don't think so.
Yeah.
We have to move on. You're on Solidarity Breakfast with Annie and Tobiah. And, it's important that you fight the good fight.
So we want to support whatever actions are going on by local communities to close down arms factories, whether it's Boeing, Northrop Grumman, BAE Systems, Thales, you name it. There's a lot of places throughout this continent, EOS, which people should be closing down, demanding their money, which they may have in their superannuation funds, are no longer invested in profiting from genocide. People need to take action for boycott. Go to the BDS movement website, boycott, divestment, sanctions, and take actions on land, sea and air to break this illegal blockade and stand with our Palestinian siblings.
More strength to your arm, James. Thanks for talking to us this morning.
Hey, absolutely honoured to be on beautiful community radio. Love you all at 3CR.
Okay, welcome everybody to this protest called by Anti-Zionism Australia. Congratulations on being dedicated enough to come out in the rain. Anti-Zionism Australia is an organisation dedicated to challenging the legitimacy and the influence of Zionist ideas in Australian society as a contribution to the struggle for the freedom of the Palestinians and for the liberation of Palestine. We were founded primarily by Australian and Israeli Jews, but we are open to everyone who wants to get involved in our work. I want to acknowledge that we're standing on the unceded land of the Wurundjeri Woiwurrung people of the Kulin Nation. This land was never ceded, sovereignty was never ceded, and we stand in solidarity with the struggle for land rights and self-determination. Always was, always will be. Now, the reason we're here today is because Melbourne City Council will be very shortly at 5:30 in session behind us. And Melbourne City Council, via its staff members, cancelled a meeting organised by AZA. And I'll go into that in a minute. But the reason we're here, in a sense, is much bigger than that, is that we're standing up against the repression which is faced by the Palestinian movement. And we should start by remembering why we are fighting for the rights of Palestinians. The United Nations reported recently and confirmed what we all knew, but what is now official, that Israel had been and continues to deliberately target children. It killed, in the first 2 years of the genocide, more than 20,000 children. 5,000 of those of under five, something like 400 of them newborns. 97% of all the schools in Gaza have been destroyed. And the killing has continued since the ceasefire. Ceasefires apparently only exist in the minds of the Israelis when it comes to the activities of Hamas. Hamas has recognized the ceasefire. Israel has killed more than 1,000 people in Gaza in the past year, in less than a year, since the ceasefire came into play. The massacres and the dispossessions continue on the West Bank and in South Lebanon. In South Lebanon, Israel is systematically destroying villages in exactly the same way that it destroyed the houses, the mosques, the churches, the schools, and the hospitals in Gaza to make the area uninhabitable by the local people. In the West Bank, in the 3 years since October the 7th, nearly 3 years, Israel has killed more Palestinians on the West Bank than in the previous 17 years. That is the continuing toll that is carried out by Israeli aggression. And I know many of you know these facts and many more, but we need to remind ourselves that when we stand up for the right to speak out, there's a reason we want to speak out. We want to speak out as part of a contribution to ending the killing, ending the oppression, ending the apartheid, and opening the way to a land of equality from the river to the sea. Now, the trigger for tonight's rally is quite simple. AZA had organised a series of seminars on different aspects of Zionism. And actually, we were coming to the last one in the series. It was the Sunday before last. On the Friday night after close of business, we got an email saying, your booking is cancelled. The booking at the Kathleen Syme Library in Carlton, controlled by this council meeting behind us. Why did they cancel? Because, and I'm quoting from the email received from the manager of all the Melbourne City libraries, increasing risks to the safe and orderly use of the facility, including potential protest activity and heightened community tensions. They cancelled us because there might be a protest. Tonight we are protesting, but they're going ahead with their meeting. There's one rule for them and a different rule for people who are speaking out for Palestine. The email continued, in recent days, there has been a significant escalation in community concern, including matters raised with councillors and senior management. Let's decode that. What that means is important and influential supporters of Israel who will not come out in public and justify a genocide, who will not come out and argue with us about the reality of apartheid, pick up the phone, maybe to the Lord Mayor, maybe to the CEO, we don't know exactly, but we know it's to senior people, and basically say, we don't like this forum, it makes us feel unsafe. And because of that, without discussion, without a right of reply, without any democratic rights whatsoever, the booking has been cancelled. And it's not the first time that Melbourne City Council has done something like this. And our argument is quite simple, that while this might seem quite a petty thing, the cancellation of one room, and we managed to get a venue at Coburg Library, and we went ahead with the forum, which was on Christian Zionism, not Jewish Zionism, Christian Zionism. We went ahead with the forum and we had 60 people turn up, one of the biggest forums that we've had to date. But the reason why we need to draw a line here tonight is that this is just the tip of an ugly and polluted iceberg. There is so much repression going on being faced by Palestinians and supporters of Palestine and the Palestine movement. In Queensland, they've passed a law that says, if you say these precise words, from the river to the sea, or globalise the intifada, you can be arrested and face very heavy penalties. They had a protest outside the court today in solidarity with the 30 people who've been arrested so far, and they arrested someone else just this morning in Brisbane. And we want to send a message, not just to the city council, but to the state government, that kind of repression will not be tolerated. We don't want them to pass similar laws. If they pass the laws, we will break the laws in mass numbers and make the laws unworkable. In New South Wales, they passed laws limiting Palestinian supporters from marching in the streets. And there, when Herzog, the Israeli president, was in town, thousands of people broke the law and marched through the centre of Sydney and actually made the law a dead letter. It's effectively been withdrawn. But we know, and there are so many cases to choose from, that repression comes at us from different directions. Think of the treatment of Randa Abdel Fattah, the writer and academic. Absolutely atrocious. Think of the treatment here of Hashtag, Palestinian man that many of us know from the rallies over the last 2.5 years. He's facing an enormous fine and legal costs over uttering a slogan. And the Royal Commission is underway, and it's a show trial with the Palestinian movement in the dock. Supporters of Israel are given free rein to explain why they feel fearful because of the Palestine movement, but the Palestine movement is not allowed to appear, and anti-Zionist Jews who support the Palestine movement are also banned from appearing. And it goes on and on. If anybody here is a health worker, you'll know that APRA, which governs the health sector, has adopted the IHRA definition of anti-Semitism, which effectively means that if you criticize the existence of Israel, you are deemed to be an anti-Semite and you can be disciplined and maybe even lose your job. Well, I tell you, as an anti-Zionist Jew, I do not want Israel to exist. I do not want apartheid to exist. I do not want Israel just to retreat from the occupied territories. I want apartheid to be smashed in the 48 in the so-called 48 territories. We want to go back to a time when Christians, Jews and Muslims lived peacefully side by side in Palestine. It was possible more than a century ago. It is possible in the future. I am not an anti-Semite for saying that, and neither are any of you. Just two last points, and then I'll introduce our first official speaker. The first is this. The Royal Commission put a lot of emphasis on the safety of the Jewish community, and in the budget, the federal government gave well over $100 million for the safety of Jews. Well, supposedly, those of us who were Jewish who were organising that forum up at the Kathleen Syme Library were apparently unsafe. Where was the money? Where was the action? Of course, it was nowhere to be seen, because support comes from the government only for a certain type of member of the Jewish community, one who endorses the actions and politics of Bibi Netanyahu and of Israel. Jews who stand up and say no to Zionism, no to apartheid, no to genocide, are deemed to be non-people, outside of the debate. And that itself is anti-Semitic, because it says that you have to be a particular type of person with a particular type of politics to be a Jew. Would we accept that argument about Indigenous people, about Irish people, about Black people? Of course not. Everybody knows there's a diversity of opinion, even if they disagree with some of those opinions. But apparently there can be no diversity in the Jewish community. And I just want to finish by quoting one of my comrades here standing at the front, Dr. Keren Tova Rubinstein, who is also a co-founder of AZA. And she said, if a government body can erase a lawful talk from a public library over a concern it won't even explain, then no one's speech is safe there. This is censorship by anonymous complaint, and it should alarm every Australian who claims to value democracy. This is not social cohesion, it is speech apartheid. So we're here tonight, and I hope the councillors can hear us, to draw a line and say, you cannot get away with this without being called out. You cannot censor peaceful voices standing for peace and justice without being called out as hypocrites, being called out as censors, being called out as complicit in the actions of Israel. And that's why we're here, and I thank you all for coming.
What's taking place in Palestine is horrendous.
Here are some ways that you can keep yourself informed and involved.
Listen in to Palestine Remembered every Saturday morning at 9:30 a.m. or listen to the podcast.
Join the APAN mailing list at apan.org.au for updates, news about actions you can get involved in, and where you can donate to provide humanitarian assistance.
Listen to other news and current affairs programs on 3CR that also cover Palestine.
The oppression of the Palestinian people has been going on for 75 years. It has to stop. You can be part of making that happen by staying informed and active.
APAN is a proud supporter of 3CR.
Tune in to the Beyond the Bars Prison Broadcast during NAIDOC Week 2026. Listen to 3CR each weekday at 11 a.m. from Monday the 6th through to Friday the 10th of July. We'll take you inside six Victorian prisons: Dame Phyllis Frost Centre, Barwon Prison, Fulham Correctional Centre, Loddon Prison, Marganeet Correctional Centre and Western Plains Correctional Centre. There'll be stories, songs, opinions and poems from the men and women inside while connecting with culture and community. The shows will be live on 3CR 855 on your AM dial, 3CR Digital, and streaming via our website or the Community Radio Plus app. Head to 3cr.org.au/beyondthebars2026 for more information.
This country's black future is a fire.
And you're with Annie and Tobiah on Solidarity Breakfast this chilly morning. Hopefully you're going to come to the birthday party.
To warm you up.
Yeah, come to the birthday party at Collingwood Town Hall. Starts at 11 a.m, goes till 4. We're celebrating 50 years of this wonderful community radio station.
I know, and there's raffle prizes.
Apparently.
There's raffle prizes to be won, which I've seen one of them is a family pass to Puffing Billy.
So people have been
pretty exciting.
Yeah, people have been working very hard to make this an exciting day. You can also come to and record your reflections as a listener of 3CR, or even you may not just have been a listener, you may have been a contributor, hands-on radio, because of course this is handmade radio for you and for all the people who present lots of diverse voices across our community at 3CR. Of course, we've just been hearing from Beyond the Bars. They're doing the going into the prisons and having a chat with the various people who are in there. And this is part of a regular event at 3CR. And it's part of NAIDOC Week, which starts on the 6th. It's not quite the 6th today, is it? No, it's the 4th.
It's the 4th.
So it starts on Monday.
Yeah, that's right. It starts on Monday. But today, obviously, we know that it's, I mean, it's not the 4th of July in America yet, but it's the 4th of July here. And so what better way to stuff the Americans than to support community radio and do the exact opposite of what they're doing?
Yeah, exactly. I had a chat with Dr. Judith Buckrich, who has put out a book called Fitzroy North, People, Place, Protests. And it's quite fascinating because if you know this suburb or any suburb, when somebody writes a history of a particular place that you know, it becomes really fascinating and answers questions that you've probably had in the back of your mind but you didn't know. So here's some of the chat I had with Dr. Judith Buckrich. I'm really interested in your approach to history. You've particularly decided to be particular about a place. So because Fitzroy North is the type of place it is, and some of the houses and buildings are still there from the very earliest period.
Yes, yes, that's right. Yep.
You're tracing the bones of the suburbs from its inception. Tell me about your approach.
Well, look, this really began for me by accident. My very first book about Melbourne was about St Kilda Road. And it was pre the internet days, so I had to go and search for people. Two things happened when I was doing St Kilda Road. One was that I found that the National Trust had a file on almost every old building that had been in St Kilda Road. And, you know, there were beautiful buildings there. There's only five left now of those. And then a property developer friend of mine gave me the equivalent of that time. So 25 years ago when I was doing St Kilda Road, all the buildings that were there then. Hmm. And so I had this fantastic source of information about every lot of land. And then I found the Sands and MacDougall directories, which are really just my Bible. I have been using those, and I look every 5 years at, you know, the same street, the same place, over and over, and that's how I find all the extraordinary people who have lived there. Do you know, my thing is to look up any weird and strange name that I come across. I know this sounds so banal, but in Fitzroy North, it really worked because the demography changed so much. I mean, initially, of course, in the 1870s, and it wasn't a suburb, really, didn't begin till the 1870s. Nothing north of Alexandra Parade existed. It was just open land and very barren land too.
It also wasn't called Alexandra Parade. It was called something else. Reed Street?
Reed Street, that's right, yeah. So, and it was really a drain. I just couldn't understand why nothing had happened. There were a few buildings along the Mary Creek towards where Northcote is now, and that was much more developed than Fitzroy North. So then I found a reference to how horrible and windy it was in the winter and very difficult to traverse, and how hot and dusty it was in the summer. And I thought, oh, okay. So it wasn't very inviting.
part of what reading your book, which I found incredibly fascinating because of the pictures, for a start, and also because I've lived in Fitzroy rather than Fitzroy North. I've always known that there was a demarcation between
the two.
There's a whole sort of feel of difference between the two. But one of the things that's quite fascinating to me and quite horrific is the speed with which there is a colonial takeover and the removal of the indigenous population. They only arrived here in 1835, and by, as you say,
1870, they had pushed everyone out of the vicinity of Melbourne. And if you read William Thomas's memoirs and diaries, because he was actually a really quite decent guy and devoted to the people, he was the protector of Aborigines, that was his title, in that early period. And so he was actually travelling with them and always trying to find a place where they could actually remain. And they just got pushed out of every place. So in the end, it wasn't disease, well, it was disease, but it wasn't that they were being shot or whatever. They were starving. That was why they were dying, because they were starving. And so because he had this real devotion to them and was trying to, in a you know, very colonial sort of way, but he really was trying to help them. And because we have his diaries, we know that along the Mary Creek there were huge numbers of Wurundjeri people. That was
and it was a meeting place. That's
especially where the Yarra connected with the Mary Creek.
That's right, yeah. I mean, so it's really interesting to get it visually in your mind, because it's such a short period of time. And struck me was the speed of colonisation and the bureaucratising of theft, effectively.
Absolutely. And I mean, you know, and it was so mean, you know, like I didn't realise until I was working on this book, or maybe it was the Yarra River book, which was my previous one, that La Trobe actually organised for every dog to be killed in Melbourne. And he did that because, you know, he said they were a nuisance wandering around the streets. But he did that because it was Indigenous people who had the dogs. And that was one of their ways of being able to survive, was that they used the dogs for their hunting. You know, so there was just this kind of really very mean, you know, using the law, bureaucracy to kill people. I mean, it's an age-old thing, you know, we've witnessed it in our own lifetime. So it's really, it was a shock. But then also I don't think it was very populated by Indigenous people. What is Fitzroy North now? The Mary Creek part would have been, because really it was just stony ground, you know, and that was why they had the quarries there.
Yeah, that was interesting to me too, because I, for a long time, I've wondered, because I was actually brought up down in Warrnambool, and of course the whole of Western District is full of extinct volcanoes, and there's a lot of bluestone basalt buildings. Yeah. And so I know where those buildings came from. But I've always wondered about the very old buildings in Fitzroy North and Fitzroy that are actually basalt, because it's such a beautiful stone, very hard, very hard. So they've all been taken from quarries that used to be existent along Nicholson Street and places
that. That's right. And some of the first pubs and churches were built for the quarrymen who were working there, not necessarily living there, but working in those areas. The effect of social change is really important for me, because I'm a feminist, and so I always want to know what was happening with women. Also, you know, the class system was so rigid and then got looser and looser. But Fitzroy North was really different in this way, because it's not like South Yarra or Toorak or Fitzroy, or kind of mostly one class of person. Fitzroy North always had, so in the 1870s, a lot of people, you know, new blocks for sale, you know, that had just been surveyed and the streets were only just being made. And one of the reasons why Fitzroy North also came into existence, there was the Yan Yean train, which went up to the reservoir where we were getting water from.
So you've got St George's Road, which was the Yang
St George's Road,
which was taking you up to the reservoir, which is really interesting. But then there was also the business about Heidelberg Road, which was the one that was taking you up out into Northcote.
Towards Eltham.
Yeah, yeah.
But the other reason why it happened very slowly, was that they set up a state school on Alfred Crescent. Now, all of those streets had only just really been created, you know, as streets. They were all unmade, you know, there was no drainage, there was no, oh God, you know. So, but we had the very first in the world Education Act for secular, free, compulsory education in the world.
That's right.
And suddenly we had a school. So there was virtually nothing around it. I mean, there were a few houses and people were starting to move into the area because you could get, you know, a block of land quite cheap and build a house. So people who had never imagined that they could own a house before had a house. And then along Alfred Crescent and McKean Street, much bigger blocks were available. So people who had become well off were building big mansions there. And some of those, a lot of those are still there too. And these poor kids would be sometimes coming from miles away. And there were hundreds of kids going to the school, you know, with maybe three teachers to look after all of them. And the education department didn't give them enough to have a fence around the school. So almost every weekend, windows were broken, the lavatories were decimated. There were a lot of larrikins, and it's one of the things that I bring up, that in Melbourne, because we had such a huge young population and a lot of them didn't have kind of permanent employment, all of the empty spaces around Melbourne were quite filled up with young people trying to, you know, find something to do. And they would have intermittent jobs, you know, they'd run messages or they'd sell newspapers or...
The population of very young people below the age of, 15 was something like 43%
That's
of the
right.
population,
it was a
something
huge
of that
percentage.
Nature.
And this was all a shock to me too, you know, I didn't know this.
And that business about the in-between spaces being populated by these young people.
That's
it's really quite fascinating. It's just sort of like the 1980s, really.
Well, in a way, but also that Edinburgh Gardens, there was no such thing. It had been separated and wasn't going to be built on with houses, but it was a tip. That's all it was, really. And so, of course, that was a very inviting open space for young people to be.
You point out this really fascinating thing, that Melbourne became the second biggest city in the British Empire.
By the 1880s.
By the
right.
1880s. And that the population...
500,000 people. It was huge. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
With no sewerage. You know, 500,000 people and no sewerage.
The horse-drawn buses...
Yes.
And the cable trams were actually run by a private corporation, and it wasn't until the 1920s or something of that nature that it was actually taken over by what's now called the Metropolitan Tramway, tramways, when they electrified. So a very enterprising, but it made a difference for Fitzroy North because it means people could travel from Fitzroy North
to the
city.
Well, they did, and not only that, quite a few of the workshops were at the top of Nicholson Street, you know, or on the Mary Creek side. And then I just want to mention one more really important thing that I think was the old colonists' homes were established on the Mary Creek, and they still exist. And that began as, you know, two or three cottages, you know, for people who had been in the colony since the beginning to be able to retire into. But the poor things, you know, they're stuck over there on the Mary Creek, and there's nothing near them. I mean, for heaven's sake. But of course, that still exists. And I talk to people who live there now. And it's become an architectural jewel in Melbourne because there are cottages there from every period beginning in the 1870s to the present day. So you can go into this, what is really an old people's settlement, and see the architecture of, you know, 100 years of architecture there. So
then
then
of course what happens is that there's a international economic downturn in the 1890s. And right. a lot of the people that built those two-story buildings in Fitzroy North, they either lost all their money or they moved already up towards, Kew and Hugh places like
and
that.
And Malvern and Toorak, yeah. But also a lot of the people who had only enough money for a small place, there were hundreds of empty houses because people couldn't either pay the mortgage or the rent. They just couldn't stay there. And that was when a lot of the mansions became Salvation Army institutions, you know, the unmarried mothers.
Seventh-day Adventists.
Yes. And it was such an interesting place. So then you have this period where you have institutions and poor people, but some of the wealthier people remained. They didn't actually leave. And then you'll see there's a double page of the occupations of people in 1900. I just couldn't believe that there was every kind of person that you could imagine living in Fitzroy North. You know, from people, there were thousands of people who fixed shoes. There was, you know, there was a shoe repair place in every street, sometimes two. So because people didn't just buy new shoes, they had them repaired. And then, you know, there were confectioners, which were kind of the equivalent of, well, there were dairies. So, you know, those sort of things where you could every day come and buy something. And so you had this very extraordinary mix always. And this is, I think, what has made Fitzroy North like it is today. You know, they're also terribly proud of the fact that it's so kind of varied and got so many things, but it had much more.
The other strong point about your history is that you actually tell us some stories about specific people. And one of the ones that I found incredibly interesting was Thomas Shadrach James, 1859 to 1946. Now, he is a direct link to William Cooper and the Onuses. That's really fascinating.
The Aboriginalist League kind of began in his living room, and all those very important people who became the great early activists of civil rights, really, in effect.
Well, he was from Mauritius, and he has a very interesting, I mean, you have to read the story to find out where he fits in, but he married into their family. And
That's right.
This is fascinating, isn't it?
And so there's that. And then, you know, there were lots of, you know, the fellow, you know, who invented physiotherapy.
I know. A world first.
You know, the Chinese detective. I mean, I just couldn't, you know, this is why that thing of going through the sands of MacDougall and looking at every weird name, I Googled every weird name that I found. So I was looking at every 5 years from 1870 onwards, and every time I found a really, and I don't mean just Greek or Italian because I'm Hungarian, so I wasn't, you know, looking at that. And there were huge numbers of Greeks and Italians living in Fitzroy North. But it was so interesting to have done that. And of course, there were Chinese market gardeners all along the Mary Creek. You know, they were there. And then as we move toward today, we had all of those groups who protested the towers going up, you know, where public housing towers, you know, that now they want to tear them down. But, I mean, at that stage, there were, you know, a really awful photograph of that elderly woman with a rifle in front of her place saying, "My place is not a slum."
That's right.
And they stopped it. And they didn't just stop it in Fitzroy North. They stopped it all over Victoria because they found out that the government was getting its supply from a certain source and that it was actually paying more for it than it could have if it went to another source. And so somehow they managed to stop the government from building any more of those towers.
So they were showing that there was an element of corruption involved.
Yeah, they did their research. They were the most extraordinary people. And then saving the swimming pool. There were so many protests that worked.
Yeah, because what you're really showing is that there are groups of people from different hierarchies in society who made Fitzroy North their home because they loved the place.
That's right.
We're celebrating 50 years of 3CR on Saturday the 4th of July at Collingwood Town Hall. There'll be stalls, displays, great food, performances, activities, prizes, and so much more. It's a birthday for us, and we can't wait to celebrate with you. Saturday the 4th of July, Collingwood Town Hall, 11 a.m. till 4 p.m. Bring your family, tell your friends, all are welcome. 3CR, celebrating 50 years.
Let us know you're coming. Go to Humanitix and search for 3CR to RSVP.
A week solidarity bricky team listener, when the esteemed practitioners of the property market, developers, real estate agents, valuers, landlords, investors, have told us incessantly they wanted nothing more than to see housing, a roof over people's heads, be affordable. Affordability is good. And now, as valuations have fallen ever so slightly, making a roof over people's heads that itsy-bitsy small bit more affordable, the same esteemed practitioners tell us this is a disaster. Affordability is bad. They seem very confused. Like some socialist MPs who expressed concern the budget tax measures may, quote, create the perception of socialism. Oh no, socialism, the last thing the Socialist Party wants. Well, we can safely assure those MPs there is not the slightest risk. The budget created even the most microcosmic perception of socialism. All confirmed by Big Supremo Anthony Albanese telling Caucus Tuesday, the Socialist Party is not opposed to wealth, as if we needed to be told. Although the wealthy had major problems to deal with come Wednesday, when the new 4.75% wage rise for the lowest of low paid came into effect, the True Blue Aussie Chamber of Commerce and Industry profits warning yet again, 4.75% for the lowest of low pay would weigh down business activity and suffocate businesses' ability to thrive. When will evil unions and lazy avaricious workers listen and learn? Can't they see the damage they create? Expressed also by Reserve Losses Bank Supremo Michelle Bulldust and the board of working class economists, who said the wage increase would exacerbate inflation and may force them to increase interest rates yet again. These wise people understand the delicate flower that is the economy is so fragile, not prepared for the bulldozer tactics of the evil unions and lazy avaricious. To make matters worse, the iconoclastic Greens moved a motion that workers under 18 should be paid superannuation, prompting the Chamber of Profits to call for the smelling salts. It would have very significant consequences for the small business community and the broader business community, we think he means therefore all of the caring business class. The proposal is sometimes put as though it's free money, and the Chamber of Profits knows nothing is free, especially money. The Socialist Party policy from its 2023 conference ensures all workers accumulate superannuation on every dollar earned, and so, true to form, the socialists oppose the motion. The Chamber can breathe more easily, and can breathe even more easily, even if after Wednesday the poor no-free money crippled by a wage rise for the lowest of caring employers now also have to pay super weekly rather than quarterly, as figures this week revealed that 28% of workers were underpaid their super, costing $6.3 billion a year in lost retirement savings. But on the positive side, all those savings for their beleaguered caring employers hanging on to the not free money. Maybe just hanging on, see the first 10,000 fans entering one Melbourne venue to watch this morning's True Blue Aussie World Cup match were given a, quote, free hot breakfast. Ham and cheese toasties, croissants, vegetarian quiche, cheese and bacon rolls and sausage rolls. Given the vegetarian quiche is the only item with a rough chance of not being lethal, most of them would have been lucky to make it through the match without going down with a heart attack. Hope there were plenty of paramedics on standby. Sadly, thousands have been going down with a heat attack across Europe. Extreme weather now predicted to be the norm, as Europe has the dubious honour of being the fastest warming continent. Much of the media, at least, conceding the disaster is down to climate change, if there is such a thing, but not the Lord Rupert of Wapping Sin, for instance, which managed to report the heat wave and deaths and related consequences without managing to get the words climate change into its coverage. Probably because Lord Rupert knows there is no such thing. Lord Rupert and his team of journalistic lackeys know the boards and CEOs of the great responsible fossils can sleep comfortably in their beds, air-conditioned homes, knowing they bear no guilt for the deaths and destruction. It's the weather, stupid. And brickbats to biased critics like me, and dare I say we, who suggest they should be dragged before the world court and charged with crimes against humanity, and for that matter, against nature and Mother Earth. Especially when responsible socialists like Anthony Albanese and Climate Pollution Minister Chris Bowen to Capital and Environment Pollution Minister Murray Swatz the Environment know the solution to all that climate disruption is to keep approving gas and oil and coal so they can transition from gas and oil and coal, which is, they tell us, their very raison d'etre for developing more and more gas and oil and coal. And how can we question such responsible ambition? Although Anthony and Chris and Murray and the Pollution Resources Minister Madeleine King Hit the Planet, who just loves a bit of gas, have upset the poor dears with their proposal that 20% of our gas should be reserved for the domestic market, which we've learned from the responsible CEOs and boardrooms would be yet another dagger in the heart of the economy that would destroy the world as we know it. The usual litany: stifle investment, shatter confidence, disrupt certainty, render us an unreliable trading partner. Certainty is always one of their big concerns, always comes into it. We assume the certainty to continue to make a killing financially and environmentally to their big socially conscious heart's content. Why, Western trooper Aussie caring business class scion Ryan Stacks of Wealth warned the move would destroy small energy companies, like several small energy companies in which he has an interest. What a disturbing thought. Energy companies destroyed. While a Japanese energy importer screamed disaster, it could threaten the profit we make on selling your true blue Aussie gas. He was aghast. And one of our favourites, Woodside with Profits, would have to postpone investment in Bass Strait until the matter was cleared up, because heaven forbid, 20% into the domestic market could have the unforeseen consequences of making gas cheaper in the domestic market. Indeed, there's a dispute within the caring business class itself between big gas industrial users and big gas producers of our gas. The industrial users demanding the government intervene to ensure the highly profitable prices, brackets for the big gas producers of our gas, close brackets, are reduced, while the big gas producers of our gas, like Santos, the prophet, say, of course, this would deter investment and destroy the world as we know it, meaning we suspect, for its supremo Kevin Gallagher prophets, the world as he knows it, countering that he'll lower his outrageous prices if the manufacturers lower their outrageous prices, leaving us to ponder, as the poor manufacturers call out for government intervention, whatever happened to market forces, laissez-faire, those sacred tenets of the greatest little economic order of them all? That gift to the coppers of the legal profession, Moira damning her own lot back in court, attempting to prevent her own lot disendorsing her, leading No Notions that appalling Hoon son to screech she didn't want her. I want a person with integrity and honesty, and I don't see that. Well, there's a lot that appalling doesn't see, but come on. Moira is ideal, No Notion moron culture material. Although, given that appalling's comments, we recommend Moira sue her for defamation. In fact, Moira would be advised to flog her house and pitch a tent outside the Supreme Court. And then, even better, she could sue the council for trying to move her on. Win-win. also winning big time, US of the UN, of the US of the world, big supremo Donald Trump or the poor. Figures this week showing he's making a fortune out of being big supremo. His family's making a fortune, but no worries. There is not the slightest conflict of interest in Donald making fortunes from matters over which he has regulatory control. What a pity we're not able to obtain a US odd passport, because Donald launched his new 250th anniversary passport this week with a beautiful photo of himself, the main feature. The Patriot passport. The United States of Trump or the poor. Oh, and he assured us for the 1,443rd time, negotiations with evil Iran are going well, even if he may have to bomb them off the face of. And as the big four transnational consulting stroke accounting behemoths continue to rake in billions from the public purse, while getting up to a little bit of illegality, one of them, EY, for everything yours is mine, got sprung as it did a consulting job for another honourable corporate, the Witch Bank, which used to be our bank, breaking into Anthony Albanese's private account. Now, there was the midwinter ball the other night when all the pollies and the big corporates get together and have lots of fun. And EY had booked one of the expensive tables providing access to the government and, what do we know? What a surprise. The day before the EY supremo discovered he had a prior engagement he'd totally forgotten about and couldn't make it, sending a lackey in his stead to face the opprobrium. Finally, the ball not only charges for the corporate tables, but also has lots of fun auctions for which the big end of town bid away, spending quite a bit on the night, all for charity, letting the government off the hook for not providing those services in the first place. Well, we've got nuclear submarines and billions on the merchants of death to finance, and a few dollars for charity sure as hell beats paying taxes. Good morning.
Yeah, good morning, Kevin. And, of course, Kevin does a great roundup of the news with a very sharp knife of satire. But as he often says, he doesn't need any help because they give it all to him, all willingly. You're on Solidarity Breakfast with Annie and Tobiah, and reminding you that you're invited to come to the birthday party for 3CR that starts at 11 at the Collingwood Town Hall. We'd love to see you there. We'll be there.
We will be there.
Yeah.
You get to meet everyone. The whole crew's coming out. Apparently, Mercedes from a Friday rave looked into one of the dusty cupboards here at 3CR and dug up some original banners from back in the day.
Oh, wow.
So they're going to be unfurling a whole bunch of history, and you can be witness to it at the town hall today from 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. And then come say hi to us.
Yeah, that's right.
And drop some coins in our purse, because Radiothon still...
Yeah, I was going to say, we've still got to make our total. We've been abysmally slow. We've only made half our total.
That's all right. We come from the rear guard.
That's
right.
We come
when we start to organize some events.
We'll get it.
We'll get you guys in. Hook, line, and sinker.
Yeah, you just got to listen out, because we'll be doing a benefit later in August. We're going to finish the program with a report that was put together by Amy Chiara, who does one of the Stick Together shows. She was the MC at a recent event, the 18th of June, calling for transport justice for the West. Fascinating voices from the West talking about just how badly they're being let down in regards to having a better bus system that makes their lives actually work. So they're not taking it lying down.
All right, so we have some wonderful speakers for you today. We're going to start with Prisha. Prisha's from Werribee. Prisha is a young person from Werribee, an avid public transport user, and a new member of the Sustainable Cities Collective, aka Better Buses. She uses PT to get to uni and around her community, but has struggled with the broken bus network for years. Welcome, Prisha, please.
Hello, thank you for the lovely introduction. My name's Prisha. I live in Tani at the moment. I've lived in the West my whole life. I have struggled with public transport my whole life. It's solely because I live in the West. many people who I travel with also struggle with public transport. It's been a constant complaint our entire lives, but yet we've never seen any justice. But we need to stop complaining. We need to seek justice. We need to complain to the Labour government instead of just amongst our community circles. I'm a uni student. I'm a broke uni student, so I do not have access to a car. I'm not able to currently drive at the moment because I'm on medication and the works are extremely drowsy and you do not want me to sleep behind the wheel. So I have to take the broken bus every single time I want to go to uni. And it has been such a struggle. It has been so challenging and it's been so frustrating to do so. It harms me at best every half an hour. And I have to wait there in the rain, in the cold for the bus, and it probably won't ever show up as well. And then I also have to allocate 2 hours to get to uni, a route that would usually take me 1 hour at best, just to allocate for the predictable transport delays. It's ridiculous. We in the West do not have access to frequent, reliable public transport. Not to mention, we do not have multiple lines of public transport. We have to rely on the horrible bus services. We don't have a tram line, and we barely have working train lines. So if you want to go anywhere, you either have to suck it up and just deal with what we got, or you have to get a car. And a car, mostly inaccessible to majority of the population. It's majority of people can't drive. It's so much effort to get a license, to get a car, and it's so much money and time and effort. We need to put more effort into getting our public transport. So and if you don't want to drive a car, you have other options as well. So yes, and the West is one of the fastest growing suburbs in Melbourne. We need public transport for everybody. Everybody has to be accounted for. We can't have people who have to rely on other public transport and are stuck at home all day because they can't get out of their house. The majority of people in the West currently do not have access to good public transport. So we have to always rely on cars. We have to rely on other people to get us around. And it's been so frustrating, especially for us in the West. Especially for those who are underage, especially for those who are elderly, for those who are disabled and cannot drive, or do just don't have the option to have to rely on other people. It causes so much strains on all our relationships and all of our independence. Especially as me, as a 21-year-old, you think I would be able to get around safely and easily. But no, I have to wait around for a bus that takes barely half an hour and is barely on time. It's ridiculous, ridiculous! So yes, we want to see the Labour government invest in the West. We want to see them transport justice. Transport goes just more getting to places. It helps our community so much. It creates community spaces. Public transport is a third space. We don't want to see people stuck at home all day. We want to see people out and about and traveling places, connecting with everybody in our community. We want to see community spaces. We don't want to see our suburb overtaken by cars and roads. We want to invest in our buses. We want to invest in our trains. We want people to stay better connected to each other. So yes, we are calling on the Labour government to implement our better bus plan. It's all laid out. It's perfect, and it will create so much change in our community. Thank you.
Jaksha is a member of the Better Buses Collective, also a member of Mount Atkins Advocacy Forum. She is a resident and new organiser. She is a mother and a worker and a community advocate fighting for justice for her community and the wider West. Everyone, welcome Jaksha. Big round of applause.
Good afternoon, everyone. I just want to say today is not about one bus, one train station, one train line. It is about an interconnected network, investment in the West for an interconnected outcome. Not one electorate, not Werribee South, not Melton North. We want to be able to go cross suburbs to our shops using the buses and trains. It takes me more than 35 minutes to get to my train station, and guess what? The train ride is actually only 25 minutes. So I spend more time sitting in the car to get to the train station than actually getting to work.
Shame.
So today is about transforming the public transport in the West. That's the rally for integrated public transport in the West. Imagine being able to go to the shops by your buses. Imagine having your kids go to sports after work by buses or trains, not using multiple cars. How many of you in the West have 2 cars? Show of hands. Why do you have 2 cars? No public transport. Imagine as we get older, we are able to go to our healthcare appointments using the bus rather than driving. That is what a good transport network delivers. Who's been to Japan? Who's been to Singapore? What do you have to say about the public transport over there?
Incredible.
Yes. Singapore, reliable, frequent, connected. Those are the three keywords. Recently, Auckland did a re-transformation of their bus network. What did that mean? More people using public transport, more women getting to work, women staying in workforce because they don't spend time traveling. They get time to spend with their family. The lesson is simple. People don't use transport because it exists. People use public transport because it works. When it's fast, when it's frequent, when it's connected. It's not a transport issue when we can use it. Public transport is not just livability, but it's an essential service. It's an economic issue. Too many parents and carers are forced to make impossible choices of staying at home and not being in the workforce due to public transport. I know women in the West have to go through reduced hours because there is no reliable transport. It's very ironical. I had a meeting at work at 8:30 this morning. I took the train at 7:15 to make sure I reach my work by 8:30. And guess what? I did not.
Same.
Because we don't have an integrated, connected public transport. I need to make two changes, one card ride to just get to work. So we are calling for fast, frequent and fair network, an equitable network where everyone's situation is recognized. A network that keeps pace with our growth of the West. The West is not asking for a special treatment. We are asking for the basic treatment of connected, integrated public transport. The question is not whether we can afford to invest in the West. The question is, how long can we not invest in the West for the better public transport? So my last word is, this is not about one train, one bus, one train line. We want an integrated public transport. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Jack. Let's now go to Grace. Grace is also from Werribee. Grace is an organizer with us for the Better Buses campaign who lives in Werribee. She's a mother and wants a future where her child can get around independently and with ease. Let's welcome Grace.
Go, Grace.
Hello. First, thank you so much, Prisha and Jaksha, for sharing your reflections. And it's a really great feeling to see us all standing together for a better outcome for the West. I'd also like to acknowledge that I'm speaking from the unceded lands of the Wurundjeri people and pay my respects to elders past and present. So as Amy said, my name is Grace and I live in Werribee. I am a mum, I work full time, I solo parent during the week, I take an evening course and I freelance. So I'm really tired, you guys. And I'm sure I'm not alone in that. My day is timed down to the minute. And it takes me an hour to travel home to Werribee with my son, where I cannot afford to wait another 30 to 40 minutes at a train station for a bus to take us home. And when the bus doesn't show, or runs 20 minutes late, or has stopped running for the night, it means my 4-year-old and I would have to walk 2 kilometers home in the dark. That's not an inconvenience. That's a fundamental breakdown of the system. That's dysfunction. And that's why I'm here today. Because 2 days ago, the Victorian Auditor General's Office published a report into Melbourne's bus network. What they found should make every person in that building up there uncomfortable. 5 years ago, the Department of Transport and Planning released Victoria's Bus Plan. It set an ambitious goal. By 2031, Melbourne's bus network would become a genuine mass transit option. Simple, fast, and reliable. The Auditor General's found that on present indications, the department will not achieve the bus plan's mass transit ambition. 5 years in, we are going backwards. The report defines a high-quality bus service as running at an average frequency of 20 minutes or better between the hours of 6 a.m. and 8 p.m. Monday to Friday until at least 9 p.m. during the week and on both Saturday and Sunday. In large parts of the Outer West, including Werribee, where I live, less than 10% of the population can actually access a high-quality service. Less than 10%. The department has not been transparent with Victorians about its progress. There's been no public updates, no honest reckoning with how far behind they actually are, just silence. And now, I have to concede, yet the Labor government has done some things. In the 2025-26 budget, it invested in new services in Tarnate, in Rockbank, and Werribee. And that is real. That really does make a difference to people. But the Auditor General's office has told us in plain language that incremental route upgrades cannot deliver the scale of reform the bus plan promised. And ahead of a state election, Victorians in the West and the outer suburbs deserve to know what actually is going to change for them. So here's what we're asking for today. It's actually not radical. It is, as Jaksha said, an essential service. We just want them to commit to the bus plan. We want transformational bus network in a grid-like pattern across the West. We need to fund that reform, and they need to report back to us honestly about how it's going and give us a timeline. Because people who depend on buses in the West, young people without cars, elderly residents, people with disability, and parents like me who are already running flat out, we're tired of being told to be happy with a few extra services on the same old broken network. If you want to help us push for transformational network reform, there are a few things you can do. Sign the voter support letter. It only takes 30 seconds, and those go straight to the MPs. So look us up on Instagram, better_buses. All the links are in the bio.
Seem like bad news all the time. We got blood and fires and wars and crime. They try to tell me who I ought to blame, but I know who it is, cause it's always the same. But don't be ashamed if you get confused when you talk to your friends or you watch the news. They try to tell you where it all went wrong. Now you don't need to argue, just sing this song. It was rich people stacking the deck. Rich people with big fat checks. Rich people, they're having a ball. Rich people been fucking us all.
People are where they are. You're going to have to meet them where they are. And you're going to have to be generous. And that's why it comes back to the idea of friendship. Friendship is never with people who are just like you. What a boring world it would be if you only made friends with people identical to yourself. You know, then again, you might as well have imaginary friends. You want to learn from people. You want to laugh with them. You want to laugh at their limitations. They laugh at your limitations. You grow together. Yeah? So politics is also like that. If you're just stagnant, you know, if somebody enters politics age 15 and when they are 35, the same person. Terrible. They haven't grown, they haven't shaped themselves. I'm Vijay Prashad with 3CR. You better listen to it because it's really good.
Well, that's the end of the program today, Herbia.
Yeah, that's it. And we're going to be packing our bags and heading over to Collingwood Town Hall, and you can all join us. A reminder that there's, I don't know, I lost count, there's maybe 15, 20 raffle prizes that you can win coming down.
Which is just interesting in itself, really.
Yeah, I mean, you don't know what you're going to get. I think there's vinyls there. I mean, the Puffing Billy stuff stood out to me. I'm going to put my $2 in, get some Puffing Billy tickets. Apart from that, come catch us down with the breakfast crew. Or come see me at the language programs with Radio Philip.
Are you're going to be schizophrenic, are you?
I have split personality today. I'll try to split the atom and be in two places at once.
Coming up next is Asia Pacific Currents. Don't forget that NAIDOC Week starts next week. They're going to be live from the various prisons throughout the week. I think the broadcast started at 11 a.m. each day, and they'll keep you posted for the voices for people from people who are inside and listening to their their dreams, their wishes, their future expectations, voices that are so rarely heard, but which are a revelation in themselves. 3CR proves itself worthy once again with such Beyond the Bars broadcasts. We're going to go out with Frank Yama, Everybody's Talking.
Listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.